Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello, this is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show coming to you live from Vachon Island, Washington, in the heart of the Salish Sea, broadcasting live from the beehive of activity called the Gene Bosch Voice of Vachon broadcast studio in the uptown core of bustling and bodacious Vachon town, and sweeping the airways of our bountiful and bucolic island community. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. Together, we, the Briefly, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent, hopefully, discussions of current events laced with humor and empathy, and always guided by Brian's mantra, less is more, more or less. Briefly panel, we've got our... Today we're missing our control board magician, and we are really missing him today as we sort of are struggling with sort of like, how does this new board work?
Don't worry, Truman, everything's
we're
fine.
Figuring it out.
But we miss you.
Yes, right.
We do miss you, Truman.
Yeah, so we're missing our control board magician, Vachon Airport Commissioner, treetop flyer, partially reformed Texan who mellowed in Montana before landing on Vachon, Truman O'Brien, who this week is at a reunion of his Vietnam Veterans Group in Colorado. He sent us all a picture of him on Pike's Peak just the other day. So, and filling in, we think he's filling in anyway, on the big board, behind the big blue switch, is our legal big old mediator, Fulbright scholar, high fashion women's shoe salesman, and Pinkerton goon, or guard, depends on how you look at the Pinkertons, occasionally coop vocalist and aspiring guitar player, Craig Bellis.
Hello, hello. It's good to be here. And I'm hoping that we will, as you introduce Kevin, we'll have his dulcet tones. Let me do a quick sound check there. Can you hear me, Kevin?
Yes, I can. I hope you can do the same.
Oh, perfectly. Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah, 10 yeah, by.
We can hear Kevin.
4 by.
But we can't hear
by.
Each other. So, okay. All right. So, also, part-time politico, affordable housing advocate, ferry fixer, Vachon Island Fire and Rescue Part Commissioner, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreyer.
Hello. Good morning.
Good to have you. And our good troublemaker, mariner, backpacker, climber, cyclist, organizer, and rower, Kevin Jones. Kevin, where are you zooming in from?
Hey, we're floating your way today from the Angler's Anchorage Marina in Brentwood Bay on the Saanich Peninsula, at the southeast corner of Vancouver Island, in our neighbors to the north, Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada. Mm.
Ah,
pleasant.
So you gave us a panoramic view of the Anchorage. It looks pretty nice.
We're just around the corner from Todd Inlet, where we anchored the other night, and we're basically south of Bouchard Gardens 2 days ago, and now we're just north of Bouchard Gardens. We literally had like a 40-minute journey from the anchorage to the dock here at Anglers, which is a fantastic spot, by the way.
Oh, great.
Well, looks great. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So I'm historian Bruce Hallman, and this week we're joined by a fellow historian, recently retired professor emerita of history at the University of Puget Sound, Nancy Bristow.
And thank you so much for having me here. It's going to be a fun time, I think.
I think so, too. I think we'll have a great show.
Always.
So before we jump into the news of the day in our usual lighthearted but passionately serious fashion, let's check in with each of the Brieflies about how things are going. So, Amy, what was your weekend like?
Well,
Well, there was a weekend?
What? There was not a weekend. I had a weekend and a weekday all on my, but like many folks, I was at Strawberry Festival this weekend, which was lovely. The weather was not too hot, not too cold, really nice, good turnout, but not like not a jam-packed, uncomfortable event. The food was great, the bands were great, but I was at the Vashon Household booth all weekend, so I am tired and cranky.
Oh, good.
That's good. Nancy, are you ready for this?
All right, then. My questions might get a little pointed, yeah, right. A little heated up in here. Right?
All right.
No, but it was
I'm glad I'm sitting on the other side of the table here. Yeah, right.
Nothing like a cranky Amy to get the show started,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. No, but I will say, you know, of course, shout out to everyone who made Strawberry Festival possible. Thank you, thank you. I particularly enjoyed Hell's Bells, for sure. They were really fun at the main stage. And then another band I really enjoyed, we went up to sports after that, and they had Panda Conspiracy. And it was this group that it was a little reminiscent of Publish the Quest, but it was like Faw, Skunk, Groove, really great musicians. You know, each one of them played two or three instruments kind of thing, you know, so they had trumpet and baritone sax and flute and accordion and keyboard, bass, guitar, vocals, just kind of put it all together in some like modern funky Flaming Lips meets the Yard Dogs meets Sublime sort of vocals. It was really cool. It was a fun time. But, you know, then I was like up and at 'em Sunday morning. But I did rig up at the booth a TV so we could watch the World Cup final.
Oh, wow. Well,
on Sunday.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right.
And the award presentation.
Yeah.
Oh, highlight of the tournament, really, yeah, for most of us,
yeah,
right?
That's right?
Oh, my Lord.
We'll talk more about the award ceremony, I'm sure. Greg, yeah, other than sort of emceeing the parade and the car show, how was your weekend?
That was it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of preparation. You got to put in a little bit of preparation for those because we normally get the information about the participants in the two parades about 15 minutes after the parade's begun. and not in order, by the way, because the main parade, it's first come, first serve as to how they line up. So that's always a challenge. This year we had you know, high-tech communications. We had our Arlette Moody down at the front of the parade and Cindy Hoyt standing behind us getting messages as to the basic order of how things were proceeding so we could ruffle through all of our pages. But it turned out okay. It really did. It really did. And it was an improvement over prior years, in my opinion. We had more notice so we could talk a little bit about everything that was in the parade. Jeff Hoyt was my co-MC on Saturday, and of course, Jeff Hoyt has this incredible voice, you know. He does all these, you know, audio books and all the advertisements and everything. So it was a real pleasure and an honor to work with him. And people ask me, they go, what was your favorite group or float or whatever in the parade? And it had to be. Now, you might say it was the Thriftway. They were great to be back. The Thriftway shopping cart drill team.
Always a highlight.
Always, always. Except for last
year. Last year, when exactly.
That's right.
I've been talking it up all week.
Yeah,
and then
yeah. But the tool library really put on quite the show.
Yeah.
But my favorite were the Shrugs.
Yeah, Free Shrugs.
Free Shrugs. You know, it's like, yeah. They walked by, you looked at them, and they went, meh. You know, it was so Vashon, you know, that was great. And then on Sunday, the car parade, which I haven't missed for, I think, 25 years, but as a participant, this is the first year I wasn't actually in the parade. Can't do both. But I did go down. I did have a car in the show, so they were graciously let me drive it down to the showing place at the chamber before the parade. So I parked it in a primo spot.
Do you know who won the car show?
There are many categories.
Yeah,
okay. I know that that our one of our major supporters and participants, volunteers, Hugh Turner. his Ford coupe won one of the very first and major awards.
Nice.
So that was really good. And I did want to thank all of the people at the Voice of Vashon, all the technicians and all the people, because we have all this new equipment that we got as a result of a grant that we received. So we have a lot of new audio equipment and video equipment is mostly. And I thought that they did a fabulous job of filming both parades. Real high quality video and audio. And you can watch it. Just go to the voiceofvashon.org and they'll send you on your way to the actual video, which is on YouTube, amongst others, I think.
It's like it's getting up there. It's like Rose Parade. It's like being in the Rose Parade. Mm-hmm. You got to stop at the grandstand, do your little thing for the, you know, it literally said, perform here.
I know.
We had stop and perform here.
We had signs saying stop, right. Which confused the heck out of the people downstream because there would be these
rough
big gaps and they'd think that was the shortest parade I have ever seen.
Rough for a parade.
That's right. Yeah. So, no, there's more coming. Don't leave. Don't get out in the street. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. But it was a great weekend. And the staff of the Voice of Vashon just did a terrific job. Got it all together. And I want to thank all of them for the work that they've done.
Yeah, it was very professional. The steady cams, you know, walking through the parade. I mean, it just was really very interesting. So very well done. So, Nancy, what was your weekend and week like?
Well, like everybody else, I kicked off my weekend with the Strawberry Festival. Shout out to the Snapdragon stage. Always such a good vibe, good food. The band on Friday night was a Grateful Dead cover band, and I'm from that generation. So just the perfect way to go into a weekend, and just gratitude then for, as you said, everybody who makes this thing happen. It's just an extraordinary event, and it takes the entire island to make it happen. So started with some strawberry festing. I'm mostly right now learning how to retire. So it's an awkward thing. So my highlights are things like I made dinner for the family. I spent time hanging out with my mom, who's 96. I actually watered my garden, which was, you know, crying out for help. Mm-hmm. So it's my highlights are really mundane these days.
Those count.
And I am so grateful for them. No, it's unbelievable. I practiced my flute. I mean, I did all kinds of really unimportant things this weekend, and it was fabulous.
You should listen to the Brown Briefly more often, because the mundane is elevated in our weekly check-ins. I think so.
Have you got to the point where you wonder how you got anything done when you worked?
Oh, within a week of it, I was like, oh my gosh, I have a few things I do still need to do, and like I haven't moved out of my office. Who has time to move out of their office? I've got other things to do. Mm-hmm. I think the university would like me out, though. So we'll take care of that soon.
I'm sure they'll take care of it if you don't, right?
Exactly. Oh, yeah, if only.
Hey, Kevin, tell us about your cruising adventures.
Well, you know, I've been trying to figure out when I last checked in, which was probably in Sydney. Which is, again, a fabulous place to visit by land or by water. But from there, we went up to Ganges on Salt Spring Island. I think of Salt Spring as Vashon on steroids. It's a bigger island. They have lots of 4-H cattle type things. They got gardens. They got goat cheese everywhere you look. It's a pretty spectacular place. So we enjoyed that quite a bit. And then up to Telegraph Harbor, which is a very laid-back on Thetis Island, I believe. So we spent a couple of days up there. And then cruising down south, we were heading for Genoa Bay, but we saw that at a place called Musgrave Landing, just on the southwest corner of Salt Spring Island, had space on the dock. And I'd never stayed there before. And it's the place that you can get off the boat and go up to the top of Bruce Peak on Salt Spring, which is I think it's the highest point on Salt Spring. And it's bristling with radio towers. So if you ever want to find out where Bruce Peak is, just look for that. Then from there, we headed into Genoa Bay, beautiful restaurant down to Mill Bay. We've basically been hanging out here inside the Saanich Peninsula. Todd Inlet the other day, which was a great anchored spot. and now here at Anglers Anchorage.
Wow, sounds like a restful, enjoyable kind of time. Yeah, and it's interesting. Ganges is kind of like Vashon on steroids, but also a time loop back a few generations. I mean, it just hasn't sort of developed in the way that Vashon has. And it feels very much like Vashon in the 60s and 70s.
It is. I went for a nice bike ride this morning off to the what's called Land's End, which is the very north end of the Saanich Peninsula. There's about two or three Indian Native Canadian reserves that you pass by. So that was really enjoyable. But the one highlight that I did stop and take a photo of, a Munkopuzzy tree loaded up with monkeys. All kinds of stuffed, fluffy stuffed monkeys in the monkey puzzle tree. Very cute.
I thought somebody broke out of a zoo or something.
Right? Wow, sounds like a wonderful week. So how many more weeks are you cruising?
Oh, let's see. We're delaying our return. We'll be back on August 7th, I believe, which is a Friday.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we'll enjoy it. Hopefully you'll be able to zoom in from other anchorages.
Well, you know, we'll be back in the States here. We're going to go over to Sydney again for a few days and then head over to San Juan Island. And once I get into the U.S., I can use my cell phone if the laptop and the Wi-Fi doesn't cooperate, because I don't have a phone service here in Canada, except when I'm connected to Wi-Fi.
Gotcha.
So have more flexibility next week.
Great. Good. Look forward to it. So for me, Strawberry Festival is always a fun weekend. It was interesting this weekend. Pam wasn't feeling great on Saturday, so we stayed home and watched the parade on live feed, Voice of Vashon, and it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It never quite makes it up for not being there, but it's still, I mean, the Voice of Vashon team, they must have had, what, three or four cameras working? And
more than
Wow. I mean, it was just fantastic. And
we had monitors, and
the commentary was even understandable.
Well, I don't know about that. I wouldn't go that far.
Don't get carried away, Bruce.
But it was interesting. So, so I highly recommend, if you didn't get to see the parade, pop on voiceofvashon.org. Look for the parade, and you can sit there and watch it, and it's very, very well done.
You know, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention the name of my co-MC for the car parade, the remarkable island legend, Captain Joe Wubbelt, who was quite knowledgeable about automobiles, but his Shakespearean delivery. That's also remarkable, and somehow he was able to get the things he wanted to say in during the time that these cars are buzzing by.
Nice,
which was great. And we miss Kate Dowling, who always brought great color in more ways than one to the parade. She was famous for saying, "I like that car. I like the color of it. I've got some toenail polish that color," which maybe didn't tell you a lot about the car, but you know. Told you a lot about Kate.
Yeah, it's fun. It's literally really color commentary.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and Captain Joe is not known for being succinct in his statement. So,
well, he's not known for being terse, but he is.
Exactly. good. And also the car parade is available on Voice of Vashon streaming, so you can watch it.
It's all over social media. I think you can get to it from our Facebook page as well.
Great, good. So, and of course, this is the third week of a 7-week crab season. So, Sunday and Monday, we were out crabbing and doing actually pretty well. But it's just such a joy to get the grandkids out. And they're getting quite agile at catching crab pots as we cruise up to them. And it's sort of like they're getting quite proud of the fact that they can reach over the edge and grab this pot. And then their dad or I step in and help pull it up. And it's always a great treasure hunt because, I mean, they're both the grandkids are just glued to the edge, looking over, waiting to see who sees the pot first and how many crabs are in the pot. It's just great fun. Mm. So a highlight of Vashon Summers is getting out on the water, of course. So let's check in and see what hopes and inspiration we can conjure up from today in history. Today is National Junk Food Day.
Oh, I thought every day was National Junk Food Day.
I thought it was this weekend.
I was going to say I'm already inspired now that you've told me.
Oh, wow. I don't think Skinny Pop counts as junk food, Kevin.
Oh, he's doing his best.
Nor does Lint.
That's dark chocolate. That's health
dark
food.
Chocolate still didn't count.
No, absolutely not.
Keep trying, Kevin.
Come on.
I don't see any junk food there.
Pull up the McDonald burgers. Yeah. Come on.
I'm as prepared as I can be. How about chips?
There you
No.
Were they stone ground?
Stone ground corn chips with sea salt.
Baked.
Yeah.
Baked. Of course they were baked.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Gentrified junk food, right?
Kevin is on Zoom, obviously, and is holding up these various bits of food that he has within arm's reach, and none of them qualify as junk food.
They're
I'm
fun
gonna
snacks.
I'm going to go looking for corn dogs this afternoon.
There you go. Right. There we go. All right.
That's getting closer to it, Kevin. So today is July 21st. In 1588, this was the day that the first encounters between the English fleet and the Spanish Armada took place. Mm. The long sort of battle that sort of circled the British Isles and sort of thwarted Spain's intent to invade Great Britain. It's also in 1925, the day that John Scopes was found guilty and fined $100 for teaching evolution. And even though, like in many judicial cases, even though he lost the case, he won the war. And sort of, you know, it was sort of the last great stand of non-Darwinian creationism in the schools until recently.
Well, I was going to say, hold on a second. I used to teach this, and my students would be dumbfounded that there had been a time when you could have a case like that, right? They're not so surprised anymore. In fact, it gets harder and harder to get them surprised by things.
Mm. Oh, yeah, no. And if you've never seen it, the great movie Inherit the Wind, about the Scopes trial, and it's just exceptional film. So in 1949, this is the date the U.S. Senate ratified the NATO Treaty.
NATO, what's that?
Yes, another one of those things that's in danger. Mm. And in 1974, the U.S. House of Representatives approved two articles of impeachment against President Nixon that ultimately led to his resignation. Mm. And in 2024, more recent history, this is the day that Joe Biden dropped out of the presidential race for the 2024 presidential election. And we've all seen the consequences of that, of course. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Nancy Bristow, our small talk guest today. So Nancy is the author, and not to embarrass you, Nancy.
I already am. As soon as you say not to embarrass you, I know I'm in trouble.
So Nancy has written three major works that we'll spend some time talking about today. The first was Making Men Moral, Social Engineering During the Great War, New York University Press in 1996. And then a really applicable to our time book, The American Pandemic, Lost World, the 1918 Influenza Pandemic, an Oxford University Press in 2012, and then Steeped in the Blood of Racism, Black Power, Law and Order in the 1970 Shootings at Jackson State College, again, Oxford University Press in 2020.
By the way, as I read those titles, I think to myself, here's a professor who writes books that people actually read. Those are great topics.
I can tell you the funny aside about the last two, of course, is so one is about a pandemic, and then the other is about a shooting of Black young people. By the time, right, these are both in the spring of 2020, right, we're facing both of these events, like, in our face. And my editor texts me and says, Nancy, I got a thought for your next book. puppies, kittens, yeah. rainbows. Where do you think you can go? Because you seem to be predictive right now.
It's like naming your LLC Treetop Flyers.
That's yeah. right. But,
exactly.
So, yeah, very prescient on your yeah. part, right? Yeah, so, hey. Nancy taught 20th century American history with an emphasis on race and social change, and served on the leadership team of the Race and Pedagogy Initiative at the University of Puget Sound. So, Nancy, you have an incredibly impressive academic record, but tell us about the non-academic Nancy, how you developed your career as a noted 20th century American historian, and when and how you found Vashon Island.
Well, you're very sweet, Bruce, but the truth is there's so much more to me than the academic Nancy. She's always felt the least natural to me. When I would leave for work, I would say, honey, I'm going to go pretend to be a professor for a few hours, but I'll be back.
The real me.
I felt very just fortunate that I lucked into something that suited me well. I went into my career so lacking in foresight or imagination. I knew I liked history. I graduated from college, found out I didn't like waiting tables, so went to graduate school, and I got lucky. I just got lucky. I wasn't thinking ahead. I didn't have a good life plan. So when my students are like, so when did you know? I was like, maybe a couple years into teaching. So I lucked into my career, and I have felt lucky for it every single day. I mean, the idea of spending time with smart young people every day, talking about things that matter a lot to me, and learning from them every day. So that's, I lucked into my career is what I'd say. And then I was lucky to land in a department at the University of Puget Sound, first in history and then to spend a lot of time as well with African American studies. Just, you know, the kindness of strangers, I guess, is how I got into my career. How did I land on Vashon? Biking. I was living in Tacoma, working at UPS, and biking as much as we could. And you can only go around Point Defiance Park, you know, a certain number of thousand times before you really need to branch out. So we were coming to Vashon pretty regularly and just loved it over here. Never imagined I could just move here. And my colleague, Doug Zachman, shout out Doug, who also lives on the island, was raising two small children, working full time. His wife was also finishing her PhD, and they moved over here. I was like, well, wait a minute. I'm not raising children. My husband is not working full time. I ought to be able to pull this thing off. So he sent me a real estate ad one day, and I was like, wait, you can search for real estate online? And then we met the unmatched Amy Carey, famous for many things on island, but in my life she's famous for showing me around the island and helping me find a place to live. So I, again, just got lucky and had smart, interesting people around me who helped me find my way.
Did she find you a dog?
No, because we already had two.
Okay.
But we did together rescue a bird one day.
Oh.
Yeah, while we were looking at a house. Oh. It was great. There was this, you know, we had a whole plan, and we came back and checked on it, and yeah, it was really great. No, Amy's amazing.
Fantastic.
I'm going to get back into the academic portion of your career to a certain degree. Your career does seem to put you squarely in the crosshairs of Trump's anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. What do you make of our current state of affairs? That's a big question. The current state of affairs from a historian's point of view.
You know, how do you even start to talk about that? The words that pop into mind are things like horrifying, devastating, appalling. That's not very, you know, productive, I realize. So let me just say that I could never have imagined a world in which higher education would be under assault in the way it is for its DEI efforts and that history could be under assault in the ways that it is. So every single day, if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education, which I'm learning not to read, I'm trying really hard, but every single day, these new assaults on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts on campuses. So, you know, it started with the big blow up with the major universities like Columbia and Harvard, but the ramifications trickle down to everyone. So that all of a sudden you have institutions with administrations who are proactively silencing people or discouraging certain kinds of things. I was lucky at UPS to not have anyone tell me not to teach what I was teaching, but
I wouldn't be allowed to teach any of the courses I teach in Texas, in Florida, in a number of other places. And this has had a huge consequences with research dollars for, quote, woke research being rescinded. So people who had received NEH grants losing them because they were studying things related to equity, diversity, and inclusion. Admissions and hiring policies are being changed so that you're no longer allowed to ask for diversity statements. Most importantly for me is this sort of preoccupation with what happens in the day-to-day on campuses and the trying to control what kinds of programs are available for students. So just yesterday, in fact, I thought, I'll go see what's happening like today or yesterday. Affinity housing. So housing that is targeting particular populations who may struggle when they first arrive on campus with a sense of alienation from the what tends to be at historically white college campus as a white, liberal, middle class sort of way of being in the world. Well, those are now under assault as well. And both University of Connecticut and University of Minnesota are being asked to get rid of any of that kind of housing. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, young Hmong children who are, you know, trying to wrestle with being between two worlds to maintain, you know, their family's culture and also go to university, that's gone. That's going to be gone. Mm-hmm. So every single day, as somebody who was involved in higher education, it's been devastating to watch. Now, I'm not an apologist for higher ed. Don't misunderstand me. It costs way too much. Access is really inequitable. We've got problems with things like legacy admissions. That's not what the administration is going after. They're doing the opposite, which is actually removing access, equitable access. But then as a historian, I mean, that's really the heart of the matter here. One of President Trump's first moves was his executive order 12453, wait for it, returning truth and sanity to American history. The notion behind this is that over the last several decades, history has been turned over to the radicals. He says in his executive order, I'll read just a couple sentences because it's so rich. Over the past decade, he says, Americans have witnessed a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our nation's history, replacing objective facts with a distorted narrative driven by ideology rather than truth. This revisionist movement seeks to undermine the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting its founding principles and historical milestones in a negative light. They just don't have any perception of what history is actually for, right? That's just a wrong-headed response. The idea that we're trying to foster an ideology is the opposite of what we do, right? We're really interested in what took place. What's happened over the last few decades is the inclusion of far more voices in the American story. And as soon as you start to do things like including indigenous voices, you have to talk about colonial occupation. Mm-hmm. If you include black voices, you have to talk about slavery. If you include women, you have to talk about the fight, you know, against male domination, against misogyny, and the ways in which this was not only person to person, but institutionalized systems. That's what they're concerned about.
But you put slavery in a negative light.
Yeah, this is the point. You'll wait for this. Wait for this. So the consequences of this, it's not just in our classrooms, but it's in public spaces as well. So a part of this is actually restoring Confederate memorials that have been torn down. They will be working on one for the Arlington National Cemetery at the cost of $10 million to restore a Confederate memorial that had been taken down because it had too rosy a depiction of enslavement. This spring, at the end of the semester, a colleague and I, Dr. Latoya Brackett, we taught a course on the history of civil rights and black power. And so we were touring sites all through the South. We took kids down there for 2 weeks. And at the Lowndes County Interpretive Center, they couldn't speak freely about the removal of books. But they did mention that they did have four titles that they were taking off the shelf that day. All four of them had the word slavery in their title. Now, why do we care? I mean, you could say, well, you know, why all this negativity? Why can't we just focus on the good? Why can't we just have a glorious, you know, pretty story? Because there is a lot of glory and there is a lot of pretty in the story. No question. Americans have overcome a lot over the years. James Baldwin is my go-to, the great American writer, best known for me for writing The Fire Next Time in 1963, when he warned us about the risk of a racial war if we didn't take charge of ourselves and acknowledge where we were and where we'd come from. And he says, the past is what makes the present coherent. And I love that idea. We can't know who we are, how we got here, if we don't know where we came from. And he goes on to suggest that if we ignore our racialized past in particular, we're really in trouble. He says, to accept one's past, one's history, is not the same thing as drowning in it. It's learning how to use it. An invented past can never be used. It cracks and crumbles under the pressures of life like clay in a season of drought. And what President Trump is really asking us to do is to create that false narrative of the history of the country. And that's going to have terrible consequences when we're already seeing them, I fear.
And how long is it going to take to rectify the damage that's been done?
The great, I mean, what's your sense of it? I have no idea. Historians only look backwards. Right. Don't be asking me to predict the future. I couldn't have predicted his election in the first time around. So I'm the wrong one to ask what's going to happen in the future. But that is a great concern, a great concern. And it's going to cost money. Mm-hmm. All of this is costing a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, money and grief.
And grief.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of pivoting to the rosy subject of pandemics, so, you know, obviously the 1918 influenza pandemic and the quote unquote Spanish flu, right? And kind of what we learned from that. And I had a friend who was writing a piece of historical fiction about the 1918, and she was doing it from the perspective of folks in the military bases right here. Domestically.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's marvelous.
You know, sort of just, you know, what was it like to be a soldier, you know, domestically in 1918 and how, you know, how the flu was experienced on the bases and the vast ineptitude of the government in dealing with it, right? Speak of, you know, if you don't learn from something, you are destined to stumble again. So can you tell us a little bit more about what your, you know, your research, what your lens on the flu was and what we might have learned that we didn't and what we might have learned this time around that we might take forward?
It's such a great question. And I have to say, we think of the ineptitude in 1918, and I have a much more forgiving look at that now, because I have this new awareness that you don't know how it's going to play out. They don't know what's happening in the middle of it. So I'm more forgiving, except to the extent that it was very politicized. And that's where I'm less forgiving. So there's a lot of things we can learn from 1918. And one thing, and here again, I can't take credit for this, but there's an institute at the University of Michigan called the Center for the Study of History and Medicine. And they did this massive, they pulled together a whole bunch of us that were studying the flu, and then decided even more than that, they were going to personally investigate 50 cities and look at everything, look at the newspapers, study what policies they had, look at death rates, and see if there were any implications to the use of what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions, the things we're all familiar with now, right? Wearing a mask, social distancing, closing schools and bars, even churches perhaps, those kinds of policies, quarantining. And it was very clear that those cities that had early, robust, enforced, and long-standing preventative measures did much, much better. So somewhere like Seattle actually did pretty well during the pandemic. Milwaukee did really well. Philadelphia did very badly, not entirely their fault, but some places did badly because of politicization, you know, fights, infighting, that kind of thing. So we know that NPIs, that some of those things that our people put in place right away in 2020, that was actually based on, you know, research that had been done, and it was the best that could be done at that moment. So there was some learning that I think took place that was very valuable. A whole bunch didn't get learned. And you can go on and on about this. I'll try to keep it short. Most obviously is the importance of good public health messaging. In 1918, the things that did go well in those cities that had success had a lot to do with openness, honesty, and communication about how difficult it is, because we don't know for sure. These are best guesses. Policies will change. We know this is confusing. We're frightened too. And I think we saw some of that, again, here I have a little conflict of interest because my brother was involved. My brother, James Bristow, Dr. Jim Bristow, was part of the work of a remarkable collection of people on Vashon that I think did a really good job, not only putting making testing available, making vaccines available and equitably available, but also communicating really well. Shout out to the Beachcomber, too. So, you know, Vashon, be prepared, the Vashon Medical Reserve Corps, these folks just did great work. So, again, people who really had learned a lesson that people need really honest, clear, open communication. Nationwide, we didn't learn that. I think it was really confusing for people, and it's too bad. I think that they were doing the best they could. I think nationally, we didn't do nearly as well. But maybe most important, is the need to avoid politicizing things like public health.
Right.
This is a, you know, public health is a public good that shouldn't become a political volleyball. During World War I, part of the problem had to do with the war, and that's where the ineptitude in the training camps comes from. It's not ineptitude, it's a refusal to listen to the experts. Mm-hmm. Public health people were saying, shut this down, don't transport troops, you know, you spread people out. They were trying their best, and Wilson wouldn't listen. And in fact, turned from even the public health experts inside the military could not get his ear. So some of the ineptitude there was politicization, and just as it was for us in 2020, right, where whether or not you wore a mask, whether or not you got a vaccine became sort of a stamp of one political stance or another, and that's just not useful. Mm-hmm. On all sides, it's not useful. Mm-hmm. That it's much better to be honest, open, and talk with each other about what we're doing and why we're doing it in the way that we're doing it. The other thing I think that is sort of problematic that we didn't learn is how to run a national public health system. And again, this is not a critique of people in public health at all. That is not what I mean. People working in public health are public servants who do the best they can with the limited resources that they have. And it's a really, really hard job. What we haven't thought about is, or haven't given into the reality that infectious disease doesn't care about county lines, state lines, or national lines. And we haven't figured out how to navigate that very well yet. We have a CDC, we have an NIH, but they don't have policy, they don't have control over policies. They have recommendation status, you know, for the CDC. And the NIH, as we know, is under fire right now for federal money. So again, we're in a different place than they were in 1918, but we still struggle with the federalizing, I think, of public health. Mm-hmm. And then last, and maybe most important actually, is the inequitable access to healthcare is just still was so obvious in 1918 with people going hungry, you know, thousands of people dying of starvation in the midst of this, children being orphaned with no recourse, you know, being put to work at the ages of 12 and 14. Canada decided to have a national health service. And here you can hear my politics, but it feels to me in 2020, and the statistics back me up, that poorer communities, and especially communities of color, were dying at a much higher rate. For the first few months, black community was three times the rate of the white community. And that persisted even when we knew that was the case. If you look at statistics as a whole, it remained, you know, near to almost twice as much. Similarly for the Latino, Hispanic communities and the indigenous communities. So we should have, could have, haven't learned a lot that 1918 was there for us to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just structural inequities mapped over health disparities, mapped over the already nascent movement to deconstruct science, right, and the usefulness of science, and turns out it has consequences.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, I may sound like I'm just laying it on thick, but again, I think this is a place where Vashon did really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there were people really, I heard a story this morning, actually, that during the pandemic, you know, people who were working roofers, people working in fields who couldn't get vaccines or couldn't get tested because they couldn't leave work, people were going out and doing vaccinations on site so that people wouldn't be left out of the safety net that was being built on the island. And that's it's a special thing that I think the last and one more sort of lesson is how valuable it is to have real community, have people that are actually looking out for one another. And it's easier, I think, if you're a smaller island that's used to relying on one another. Mm-hmm. But Vashon got a lot of things right, and it took, you know, hundreds, thousands of volunteers on this island for us to have a much lower death rate than a lot of other communities.
With the infrastructure already in place.
Mm-hmm. With the infrastructure already in place because of all the nonprofits.
Yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And the work of the different systems that are on island.
You might want to mention the project that we'll be starting up this fall, COVID, sort of. We started back in 2020, 2021, and got sort of cut off because of the realities.
And when we say we, Bruce means the Vashon Heritage Museum, not me. I am honored to be able to maybe step in and help with a project that they started during the pandemic. One of the things they didn't do in 1918 was keep records, to do oral histories, to collect the sort of memorabilia such as it is, the cultural artifacts of that pandemic. And it was largely sort of unrecognized as a public event almost immediately. It just disappears. It was called the forgotten pandemic, not just in the U.S., but it turns out in countries all over the world. the Vashon Heritage Museum from the very beginning made sure that wasn't going to happen and started doing oral histories of people outside the Thriftway, outside the IGA, contacting people who were volunteering for the food bank, for you name it, and started collecting oral histories, and now is working on collecting the situation reports that were being recorded like daily and then weekly by the by Vashon Be Prepared and the MRC. So we're hoping to pick those interviews back up and return to people who were interviewed before as sort of a 5 to 10 years after story. And then also hopefully interview some people that we didn't have a chance to get to because COVID just coming back and back and back. Mm-hmm. And the interviews would get going and then they get cut off again. So we're hoping to maybe start some of that up this fall.
Yeah, right. It'll be fascinating. It's that kind of longitudinal, what we're able to do in 2020, 21, and then coming back 5, 6, 7 years later and sort of seeing, what's your perspective now? I think it'll be fascinating.
Yeah. And I think it accomplishes that thing that in the wake of trauma, mm-hmm. those who have been most traumatized, the pathway to recovery is one part of what we've learned over the decades, psychologists in particular, is that the opportunity to tell your story and to be heard mm-hmm. helps, right. is important, right? We know that for sexual assault survivors. We know that it's true as well for other forms of trauma. And pandemics are nothing if not traumatic, especially for those who lost loved ones or who themselves, suffer desperately. This project gives people that chance to tell stories. And that's mm-hmm. actually a useful thing for all of us to hear because we have such an urge to go back to how things were or to at least move on from it. But you can only move on from it if you're relatively unscathed, as I was. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there still suffering and suffering largely in silence because no one's asking them about how they're doing, right? And so this is an opportunity to open those stories up as well, I think.
Great. Yeah, it should be a fascinating project. Yeah. So glad you're going to be involved.
Me too. Right.
So, Kevin, you had a question?
I'd like to shift to another important topic, which is also something that you've written about. Just a little bit of history. We talked about community earlier. This topic is discrimination and racism. And some 4 years ago, with racist graffiti that showed up in the Vashon Village Green, mm-hmm. A lot of people were motivated, including some work that I did with the Community Council to create a diversity, inclusion, social justice committee. And so given that background, I'd really like to hear your interest in the current state-sanctioned violence that we see with ICE. And some time ago, back in 1970, the Jackson State College shootings, which you wrote about, that also had state-sanctioned violence. Are we seeing a recurrence of history? What's your perspective?
Kevin, it's such a good question. It's such an important parallel. And again, in my naivete as a white, straight, middle-class, highly educated person, I keep dreaming that we were sort of done with certain things, that we turned around certain corners. And I know that that's a naivete born of my own privileged life where I have suffered so little. My black colleagues laugh at me sometimes because my naivete, sometimes it's a little bit uplifting, but usually it's just vaguely irritating. I've been surprised by just how open the racism has been and how targeted it has been and how willing I'll just be honest with the federal administration has been about building policies around kind of acceptance of racialized violence that was prominent back in the day, mostly in the Deep South, but included largely sanctioned violence, lynching that happened in the North and the West as well. What's really striking is that this is like a militarized approach to civilians, to people who are just going about their business, and you're going in guns blazing. Which is similar in both cases. Like, why does ICE need to be in such a militarized stance with tanks and armored cars and these massive guns? Like, what are they so afraid of? And they're using then in turn a kind of a language of law and order, which again, anybody remember Richard Nixon? Not everybody's old enough, but I am. This notion of we need to restore law and order, that's why we have this militarized approach. But it's a creation, it's a fiction, and it's creating criminals where none exist. So the students I wrote about that were murdered at Jackson State College, They didn't even open fire on the kids who had been causing trouble. They marched another quarter mile down to a group of kids in front of a dormitory and opened fire on them when a bottle broke. But the Mississippi Highway and Safety Patrol and the Jackson City Police could do that in 1970 and then say we were restoring order to the college campuses. We all know things are crazy out there in 1970. And that's the kind of rhetoric that we're getting today, the way that the president and many, especially in the Republican Party, are talking about immigrants suggests that they are somehow criminals, that they are dangerous. And this is just an old storyline that is used when you want to repress a certain population, and it's not borne out by the facts. So again, to have it be so blatant has been nothing short of, you know, disappointing doesn't begin to tell the story. It's been deadly. It's been horrifying. It's been terribly alienating and harmful. To not just those who are immediately targeted, but then you've got all of their families and friends and those who maybe are here and are here with all the documents in place with full citizenship. That's not enough protection any longer. So the consequences are really human and horrific. And the other thing I'd name that's a similarity that I want to put out there because it's easy to miss is the students I learned about at Jackson State, I learned about their story was told beyond their campus because it happened 10 days after Kent State and white kids had been shot. And then they're like, oh, look, it's another Kent State. Well, it wasn't another Kent State. It was, in fact, another police shooting, but it was driven entirely by racism. It wasn't an anti-war protest that they were shooting into. But they got press. They got coverage. They got front page headlines because Kent State had happened. Our attention was drawn to this sort of state-sanctioned violence against young college students because white students had been killed. And that's a terrible tragedy. And my heart bleeds, and I'm actually well acquainted with some of the folks at Kent State now. And there's a terrible thing that happened. But black students had been being, faced state violence for years prior. And no one knows about it. No one pays attention to it. Three kids had been killed at Orangeburg, 2 years earlier. Ben Brown had been shot in Jackson 3 years earlier. Campuses all over the country, the black students had been terrorized by local police. And that had been happening for decades. And so, again, it's a terrible loss, Renee Good and Alex Preddy. I'm not diminishing the consequences of those losses. But at the time they were shot, six other people had already been murdered, and all six of them with Latino last names, right? So Luis Gustavo Nunez Calcaras is somebody that none of us knew about. Geraldo Lunas Campos, we don't know his name, but he had already been murdered. So again, a caution for us to keep our eyes open. What are we missing? But yeah, the similarities are horrifyingly direct.
Well, it doesn't
seem
to.
Yeah, and there's so many great histories that, as you well know, I just finished reading John Lewis' Life by David Greenberg. And if anybody is uncertain about the dangers and the risks that those students and others took, right, to advance the democracy and to get to the point we have now, hopefully we won't retreat back. But if anybody wants to see what that reality was like, those are the kinds of books, and I'm sure yours included, right, that show the real risks that people took to advance us and get us moving forward.
So, Nancy, we're getting toward the end of the hour. Mm-hmm. We only have a few minutes left, but talk a little bit about your book about making men moral, the attempts during World War I to sort of reform military training, create a new sense of masculinity to unify the nation under a homogenous sort of American culture. And what are the parallels you see with what our current Secretary of Defense is trying to do with testosterone shots and, you know, sort of a new masculinity in the military?
Bruce, it's so brilliant. This question is a brilliant question. And the honest answer is I hadn't even thought of this parallel until you named it. Mm. And it's so similar. Right. The idea in 1918 was they would sing the right songs, which, by the way, the songbooks included things like I Wish I Were in Dixie. So, again, the kind of American they were building was one that went back to an earlier version of the United States that centered a certain kind of American culture that maintained class hierarchies and racial hierarchies very clearly within the military. In 1918, there were two black generals whose careers were really forestalled. Here we are at war. We need all hands on deck. And in rather than promoting these men, they were giving them duties like overseeing the loading of ships. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So Generals Benjamin O. Davis Sr. and Charles Young, I'll just put their names out there. And we see the same thing going on right now, right? Hegseth blocking the promotions of women, of men of color, not too long ago, I guess it was in March of this year, because those aren't his vision of what a military leader should look like. His, you know, incredible hostility to the LGBTQIA, you know, communities, but especially transgender Americans. It's this strange notion that of what masculinity means, or that somehow the military should be masculine. That masculinity has a very particular meaning. In 1918, they taught. One of my favorite authors, Alan Brandt, wrote a book about this subject. He said they wanted to create masculine, virile yet virginal men. And it's like such a good line. And it's sort of, I don't know that I'd have a different set of terms, which I won't use, for what they're trying to create now. But the parallel, again, the similarities, and what worries me, your question earlier about like how long is this going to take, Craig, for us to get back to where we were. Remember, after World War I, we go into the 1920s, which is a period of tremendous conservatism, socially, economically, politically. How long? I don't know the answers.
Yeah. We're down to the last 2 minutes. Nancy, this has been a fascinating conversation. Really appreciate you.
I feel like I've been talking my head off. Sorry, folks.
No, that's the point. That's why
you're here.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, and we'll have you back. We've touched a lot of subjects, but is there anything that we haven't touched on that you would like to touch on in our last minute?
I don't think so. Yeah, let me count the ways. No, kidding. No, again, I think... I would just say how grateful I am to live on Vashon Island and to see so many people doing so many good things to fight for equity, to fight for the continued knowledge around the nature of the Constitution and what it means to us, what the history of this island is and how we got to where we are now. I'm just grateful to be surrounded on the island because I think at a time when there is so much to be afraid of and so much to be fearful about, Vashon gives us a place from which we can put our feet down and fight back. I had a friend come over for Friday night for the Strawberry Festival and was just walked away and said, it all felt so joyful and yet meaningful. It's like, yeah, there you go.
Wow. Good, yeah. Good adjectives.
Yeah, it is definitely.
He's a historian.
Yeah. One of the historians I worked with doing my PhD was a guy who said, history is really a dialogue. It's sort of historians talking back and forth. And, you know, history is never one thing. It's just this, we're constantly seeking out truth.
Yeah. And people are making those truths as we speak. And that's the other thing, right, is we're all the makers of history. Right. It's not something that historians do. Historians look back to try to figure out what the heck happened. Right. But we're all living, you know, creating it right now.
Exactly. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining Nancy. Next week, we will have a Truman Show. And so for Kevin, Craig, Amy, Nancy, I'm Bruce. We thank you for listening. We'll see you again next week on the Brown Briefly.